As usual, you don't have to pay attention to what's written on the board. That's just so that people who enjoy something, if you're getting lost, can know roughly where I might be up to. So I'm speaking today about the interaction of politics and theology, of faith and public life. And this has come up because last year I spoke about the passage from Romans 13 about obeying government authorities. And this is part of that, and I was asked to go a bit further with that. So we're looking at the overarching question, which Tyson's rewriting for me because the blue pen didn't work very well. What is the role of Christians who are devoted to the Lord of a coming kingdom, citizens of God's shalom, while we live on earth as humans under earthly rulers? That's the big question. So I'm going to do a historical overview. You're going to probably get a bit more history than theology today from me, because that's the other thing I do. But really the question is why? Why? It's all very interesting, but why do we need to know about this? Why bother understanding different ways of answering that question? And I think most of us sitting here have pretty much in ourselves instinctively resolved the question of what our role is in terms of the wider world as Christians. And you do it. You're just doing it, more or less, day to day. But this year is a year of politics. We've got a federal election coming up with a Pentecostal Prime Minister. Within our community, we have people who are members of the Labor, the Liberal and the Greens Party. So we don't agree even within this little people about how we go about responding to that. Western Australia this year is debating legislation about legalising euthanasia. This is an area that the church has traditionally had a strong voice in, but Christians don't all agree. So for me, the reason to talk about this whole thing at all is about how do we love other Christians who we disagree with? And I want to propose two things. One, we need to know where we stand ourselves and understand the why of the thing that our gut has just kind of led us to. And we need to be aware of where other Christians might be standing, who also, with genuine goodwill, are seeking to respond to Jesus in this sphere in a way totally different to us. Because I think the goal is to talk lovingly to each other in the realm of politics, and to talk lovingly about each other, which might be more challenging for some of us as we respond to other Christians. So for you as you listen today, what resonates with you that describes where you feel sits right for you? And as we go, what do you encounter that you think, oh no, that's just not right? And listen to that and think, what can I hold and lovingly respect in that perspective that I don't agree with? So that's what I'm asking you to do today while I talk. And if you get lost, the main question is up on the top. Just go back to there. And if you don't want to listen to me, that's fine. I would recommend the red questions. Just go and sit with one of those and let it roll around in you and ignore what I say. So the red questions, roughly, This is the kind of questions that lead people to a different response and have led through history to different responses. I'm going to apologise to Luke straight up. I'm not going to tell you how to act next. Is this realm of governing... Yes, John?
There may be others like me who can't read.
Okay. I don't know that I can make it any clearer. You can come closer. There's seats in the front row. It's very attractive. And I don't spit. Or you can come up after and have a look. What I'm about to say now is basically the red questions. So if you can't read them, you're just going to have to hold them in your head. Is the realm of governing authorities a space where God operates at all? And if so, how? I'm not answering these questions. I think these are the questions that have led through history to different answers. How far does the love ethic of Christ stretch? Is this for every action? Is this for individual actions but not for corporate and state actions? Is this for matters of interpersonal relationships but not foreign policy? How do we take seriously that Christians don't, humans, never mind Christians and them too, don't love perfectly? How do we respond to that? Do we need to use force? If we do, how and when? How do we protect the victims of other people's failure to love? Failure to live out the things we just heard from Matthew from the Sermon on the Mount. As we follow Jesus, are we called to have a corporate public Christian voice, a Christian response together, or is this call of Jesus something we're to do as individuals, or a mix of both, and what's the balance? What's our core business as Christians? And does engaging with politics distract from that or enflesh and enact that? And as we make these choices and wrestle with these questions, how do we balance up the what's written in the Bible, our human reason, what's happened through history, our current experience, and not just our current experience, but the current experience of people not like us, people who are suffering, people who are oppressed? And how we balance those four corners will change what answer we come to. Okay, let's look at like 6,000 years. Go. So we start with early pilgrim wanderers in a tribal society who are not really subject to any particular authority unless whichever tribal people they walk amongst, they're very careful. And that's most of Genesis. And then we have people who are slaves under a tyrant, a tyrant monarch, and God then rescues the people. That's Exodus. Then most of the rest of the Old Testament, we have God and the Hebrew people ruling together. There is no secular ruler. The judges or the kings are meant to be the mouthpieces of God. So much of what our Old Testament presents as history and the books of the prophets come out of that context. And then we have exile. We talked extensively about exile last year. After which the rulers that the people are under are no longer followers of the Hebrew God. The Hebrew people and then the Christian people are under authorities where they have no power. So God is amongst the poor and the powerless, not aligned with the rulers. Our New Testament is entirely written in that context. Quite a bit of our Old Testament is back edited from that place. There, that's like 3,000 years there in two sentences. We're rolling. It slows down a bit, let's go. And then we get in the 4th century, we get Constantine. In 313, Constantine recognises the Christian church as a legitimate religion. And 10 years later, he makes it the official religion of the Roman Empire. And suddenly, well not suddenly, it's got to there gradually, but the church now has power that it's never had. And it's wrestling with, it's got no experience of being aligned with power. What does this mean and what does it do? And Augustine is a really important key early thinker in the Constantinian period. He writes a thing called The City of God. And he's looking not so much at the sacred and the secular, that's not a division that exists in that culture. But he's very concerned with the temporal and the eternal, the things that are going to last after you're dead and the things that are not. And that's the key distinction in how Augustine says to engage with life. Engage differently with the things that are going to be with you after you're dead than the things that are not, is his. That's Augustine in a very simple form. It's really important through this period to remember there is only one church, and that church is aligned with power. In the 16th century, we have the Protestant Reformation, and amongst lots of things the reformers were concerned about, one was that they felt that secular rulers had been telling the church what to do. From the understanding that there isn't really a concept of secular as we have it now, everything is within the realm of God, but within that, some are specially called to be leaders and advisors of the religious, the priests, and others are not. But the emperor's been telling the pope what to do, and that's a problem.
Okay, we're just shifting so people can see it.
Now it feels like it's big. I hope the little cross in front of the big whiteboard is more important.
Just so that I can look at you and the writing at the same time.
Okay, all right. We're still figuring out how to use this whiteboard notes thing, so we'll go. If you're listening to the tape at home, hopefully someone will have uploaded a picture of the whiteboard. So the Reformation challenges this idea that the emperor has the right to say anything to the church, and as part of the Reformation, the church splits, and now there are lots of churches. So there's a whole rethink required of how church relates to state, to governing authority, so state doesn't really exist yet. Because some rulers support some churches and some persecute other churches. Some will protect you and some will kill you. And in this context, you get Luther, you get Calvin. They come up with quite different understandings. I'll talk a bit more about that later on. The Anabaptists emerge, and the continuing Catholics have to do some serious thinking about how they hold the position as well. The Orthodox Church goes on, basically, as a state church and continues in that way up till the last 100 years. In England, Henry VIII declares himself the head of the church. That nails church-state relations for them. After 100 years of Reformation, the 30 years of war erupts in Europe. Well, it erupts. It's been coming for a while. But it's called the 30-year war for a fairly obvious reason. And it just is a perpetual state of violence. And it's caused by religion. This ends with the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, which establishes the idea of a nation state, a territory with a secular ruler who has complete authority in that space. And Rome does not have authority in that space. And the reason for secular nation states being developed is because religion is believed to cause violence. It's been their pattern for two generations that religion causes violence, so they establish nation states to separate the church from the state so that the states can have peace. France adopts freedom from religion in its founding documents, so it's a strictly secular state, whereas the American colonies, which are founded in the same period, adopt freedom for religion, where the state supports religious expression and supports diverse religious expression. But despite the official separation of church and state, the church retains significant cultural power, significant unofficial cultural power, except in England where it actually has actual cultural power. And this is the period in which Europe colonises the world. So the church is actively engaged in colonisation. The church is aligned with the oppressors as Europe meets indigenous people around the world. In America, the black church emerges as a response to the white church using religion to tell them they should be slaves. And the black church focuses on the resurrected Jesus as the hope for oppressed people beyond this life. They write great music too. This situation rolls on for a couple of hundred years until World War I completely dashes this idea that secular states might bring peace. World War I dashes a lot of things, but amongst the things that are shattered by World War I is the illusion that a secular state is the way to peace. And the church is really just starting to wrestle with, well, how could we be a voice for peace then, when World War II engulfs everything and brings significant change in how we think about the relationship between Christians and authorities. How are we doing? There's a lot going in here. You're doing very well. Nobody's fallen off their chairs yet. After World War II, the church increasingly becomes a minority voice within the culture. The separation of church and state that's been there for a couple of hundred years begins to become culturally a separation as well. And in different parts of the world, thinking about church and state moves in three directions. In Europe, the church is horrified at what it has enabled to happen particularly the German church, is just deeply ashamed that the quietism of the German church allowed the Holocaust, in some cases actively facilitated the Holocaust. And there's immense introspective wrestling with who are we as a church? We can never let this happen again. We did the wrong thing. And out of that space comes what they call political theology, which talks about the church as a voice of moral conscience, responsible for calling out evil in secular authorities and for shaping public morality to move towards peace. It really challenges the idea of a privatised faith. It says privatised faith caused the Holocaust. We must be public. Meanwhile, in North America, which is wealthy and pluralist, the church is trying to figure out how to be relevant, how to have a relevant voice amongst many voices, most of which are secular. And in that space emerges what gets called public theology, which is about the church working to translate core ethics into a language that secular authorities can abide. It encourages people to engage with a multitude of public roles to bend the secular towards the shalom of God. Critics of this approach will call it the social gospel. I don't know if you've heard that term. I was raised with that term as, you know, that was a very bad thing, the social gospel, don't ever go there. Its non-pejorative name is public theology. It's more about civic engagement than political action. And one of the big thinkers of this is Reinhold Niebuhr, who talks about Christian realism. Reinhold Niebuhr was a big influence on Barack Obama. Christian realism is part of his understanding of faith. Christian realism emphasises justice rather than love in public affairs as the role of Christians. And it both has this public church role, but it also encourages individual Christians to do whatever the secular job is that you do with a view to bending it towards the shalom of God. The third direction that emerges after World War II comes in the parts of the world that are being decolonised. Decolonisation brings an awareness of the oppressed voices, and liberation theology emerges, particularly in Latin America, but also elsewhere. Hearing the voice of the poor church. It often means speaking out against a church that's aligned with the powerful, with violent or oppressive regimes. So the church in this space becomes a prophetic voice to unmask systems of violence, to unmask false gods, evil powers. In America, out of the black church, the civil rights movement arises in this vein. It challenges the use of religion to oppress black Americans. Also, mostly in Western cultures, second wave feminism emerges in this era, drawing attention to the patriarchal alignment of both the church and the state. And second wave feminism particularly gifts into this conversation the notion that the personal is political. What I do in my life at home is political. As we've turned a new century, the last 20-ish years, people have started to challenge the framework that all this even sits within. Because all of that so far roughly assumes that state apparatus is a good thing. People are starting to question whether that's a good idea, and particularly whether Western liberal democracy is a good idea. So out of the political theology, there's a thing called post-liberalism, which challenges the notion that there's a separation between public and private life. This notion that the personal is political extends to become the spiritual is political, the sacred is political. And there's a significant re-encountering of Bible texts to look at how Jesus was political, not just that the things he said when you take them 100 or 1,000 years later become political, but he in his time, Paul in his time, had a political impact. It's very emphasis on the church before Constantine as kind of the golden era for us to learn from. Another kind of angle that's in, these are emerging fields, they're not, the thinking's not done in these areas, it's coming, is what's been called radical orthodoxy. And that questions the alignment of the kingdom of God with progressive leftist politics. It starts looking at pre-Reformation sources and the medieval period, and particularly re-engaging with the notion that there's no secular, that everything you think is secular is sacred. And out of liberation theology are coming more and more attention to the uniqueness of different voices, the uniqueness of black women's voice as opposed to black voices or feminist voices, the uniqueness of queer spirituality, not just for what those people are saying about their own experience, but for what the lens of those particular places tells us about the wider church and about the wider state and the relationship. And on and off through all of that period, there's a recurring theme that turns up often in times of stress or perceived threat or identity crisis, which is an emphasis on the end times. The end is nigh, so we don't need to worry about now. And in some streams of this, possibly the end can be hastened along if we facilitate the last things that are going to precede the end. And this is based on particular interpretations of apocalyptic literature. Everyone say that three times, apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic literature is the stuff in the Bible that's written in poetic language for people who are being oppressed to be a comfort language to them, particularly people who are under the thumb of a violent Roman Empire. It's prophecy in the biblical sense of telling truthfully what is really now. But it's taken, prophecy in secular meaning is to say a prediction of what is to come far in the future. And if those sacred poems of the time of oppression under the Roman Empire are taken as predictions 2,000 years forward, then we get people doing things like supporting the modern state of Israel because it's reflected in the poetry, opposing the United Nations or particularly United Nations programs because of poetic language about whole nation, international organizations. So that's not really in the timeline, that bubbles up variously. Each generation has to rethink the church's role in its own context. And each generation has more resources to draw on because we have all the successes and all the failures that have come behind us that we are drawing on to decide who we are now. Four of those particular themes that emerged out of the Reformation and have been thought and rethought in the last 400 to 500 years, I'll just talk a little bit more about, which of Luther, Calvin, the Anabaptists and the Catholics. They're in green. So these are not just in the Reformation period. These have come out of the Reformation period and continue to be live, active things now. Luther was the first person to really wrestle with what does it mean that we've got more than one church in relation to the state? And he developed the doctrine of the two kingdoms. And this is what I grew up with, and I have to say it was always the hardest bit of Lutheran theology for me to abide by. And I may not give it its full just presentation to you because of that. I'm going to do my best. The two kingdoms, one is a kingdom of law, is the name, and one is the kingdom of grace. The kingdom of law is to be ruled by coercion, by justice, by law. And the kingdom of law, which is the things we see in our world, is a necessary evil because humans are so broken that we cannot live in peace with each other without some sort of force. It is not the eternal way of God, but it's functional and necessary for our time on earth. It's not redemptive, and that's very important for Lutherans. Meanwhile, the realm of grace is the realm of transformation, and it's accessible to everyone through the work of the church bringing us in. This is the realm where God puts us in right relationship with God's self, and the realm where God works on our ability to improve how well we love each other. The idea being that the realm of grace saves us and then works and works on making us better at loving each other until we reach heaven, where we're so good at loving each other that we no longer need the rule of law to hold us in check. If any Lutherans are listening on the tape at home, feel free to tell me I'm wrong. One of the important parts of this is that all vocations are valid. Luther famously says, whether you're a priest or an executioner, you are serving God by doing the work you're called to do. Partly that's Luther's way of challenging the medieval notion that priests were more important than other people. But it's also partly affirming that this necessary evil of state structure requires diligent individuals to make it happen. This is the theology that particularly enabled the Holocaust in Germany, this separation. It has within it a sense it's not our job to save the world. And at its most extreme, it may even be seen as sinful to try and improve the world, because that comes out of a false pride in our human capacity to make things better. Calvin, at the same time, emerges, and he is the basis of Reformed theology, and he has this notion of common and particular grace. Common grace is all the good things that God gives to enable good on the earth, the rain that falls on the just and the unjust. And common grace creates the environment in which particular grace, which is the saving work of God, can happen. Who grew up with this notion? Is there something that's... Wow. I think actually a lot of you did, and you didn't ever have it told to you. Yeah. So common grace is the things that God, the good things God gives for all of us to flourish on the earth. And particular grace is the grace of redemption and salvation that comes through the church. The matters, particular grace is the matters that set us right with God. So government is a good gift of God, part of the creation, part of the agent of transformation for society and for individuals. You can see how different this is to Luther at the same time. For Luther, government is a necessary evil. For Calvin, government is part of God's good creation. So if it's part of God's good creation, our job is to engage with it. We have a responsibility to improve the social order. We have a responsibility to move secular systems towards greater justice. It also has this notion of interlocking spheres, that there's the family, the church, the state, education, your workplace. Each sphere has its own authority. They kind of interlock, and they're all under God, including the government. The Anabaptists emerge in the Reformation period, and they say that the state rests on coercion. Christian life is based in the love of Christ. The love of Christ runs everything. We are only to express the love of Christ, so we must withdraw from the state. We express the love of Christ through communal practices of life together and liturgy and worship. Because the state is based in violence, and we cannot be a part of violence. So the Anabaptists, the role of the church is to model an alternate way of living to wider society in the hope of changing things, but the state is left, that's so beyond the pale for Christians that you must not engage with the violent state. And the continuing Catholics had to do some thinking too, and out of the Catholic understanding is this sense, they call it Catholic social teaching, the sense that anything that upholds human flourishing embodies the work of God. So the church's role is institutional primarily, to teach members of the church what it means to uphold human dignity. It's based, embedded in the idea that all people have human dignity. All people, no matter what you've done, which is why there's often voices against the death penalty, no matter whether you can speak for yourself or not, which is why this has a strong things to say about abortion or euthanasia. It focuses on the common good, doing works that enable the common good. This is why Catholics are so involved in education and healthcare. always about improving human dignity. And there's an institutional role to advise secular authorities on appropriate ethics for governing. Right. That's all very theoretical. You've done admirably well, not falling asleep. I want to put some caricatures into an image to try and give something to that to hang on to. Oh, I'm getting too long. So our context is the Western liberal nation state, the individualist free market capitalism. This is what dominates us and most of the thinking that has thought into this conversation. And one of the authors I read talked about modern liberalism being like a hotel, which facilitates the private business of all the residents without any particular obligation to each other beyond do no harm, which is going to keep the noise down. And I really like this image of the hotel. It got me thinking. So I'd like us to imagine the hotel of Western liberal democracy. And we're just going to see if where these people are in it. I'm using caricatures, not straight descriptions, so if it needles at you, I am exaggerating. The Lutherans acknowledge that this hotel is not really how God intends us to live, but they're very grateful it's there, otherwise we'd be out on the hillside killing each other. They're all working extra hard at whatever they've given to do, but if you really ask them, the thing they're going to tell you is how pleased they are that their ticket home's been paid up in advance fully. The Calvinists believe the hotel is there to help us become more Christ-like. So they've joined the management team. They are working on drafting better employment policies and a sustainability plan to reduce the hotel's carbon footprint. They have a vision of the hotel as a haven of mercy for the wider world, a beacon of hope for the residents. They have very high moral standards if you want to join their committee. The Anabaptists have taken up several adjoining rooms and knocked out the intervening walls. They're living together without any servants or bosses. They're all sharing the load and they're trying very hard to live like Jesus. They're not sure they're making any difference to the servants in the basement. The Catholics are running a school in the basement for the servants' children and a medical post on the fourth floor. They are periodically writing carefully considered letters to management, outlining the ethical considerations to ensure everyone in this hotel is treated with dignity, especially the unborn and the very old. The Black Church are following Jesus. Jesus previously worked in the hotel laundry and was killed in an industrial incident that nobody really thinks was an accident. The Black Church is currently on a slow march from the basement to the top floor, calling for full acceptance of black people as residents of the hotel, not an underclass of workers. And they are praising Jesus that one day they'll be going on beyond the hotel. The liberation theologians are holding nightly meetings out the back with the indigenous community that was displaced to build the hotel. And during the day, they're bringing opinions from the Indigenous community to board meetings. There have been some run-ins with the security forces. The security forces keep the hotel grounds just for hotel residents. There was particularly some run-ins after the Indigenous community reclaimed the vegetable garden and redistributed the harvest. Some liberation theologians even got between the security forces' bullets and the Indigenous community. And some others are currently planning a raid on the security forces' armoury. There's a group of Christian activists from across the traditions who just feel everything's moving too slowly. The institutional church is hopeless, and regardless of which approach they're committed to, the old ways are just not making a difference. So they have simultaneously jammed all the lifts to protest against the use of hotel fees arming the security guards. And they are currently sitting in the manager's office singing peacefully hymns until the refugees kept in an alcove off the foyer are given proper rooms and the right to work. The premillennial dispensationalists are encouraging the guests urgently to check their ticket home is valid because some have been peddled as fake. They are also fundraising to install green windows on the 13th floor because they have a sacred poem describing the 13th floor as being green when the hotel closes for good. And the Anglicans used to co-own the hotel. And they are still working out what to do now that they've only got the run of two floors and a ceremonial role at management meetings. There's internal dispute about whether speaking up for the rights of the hotel staff will mean getting restricted back to one floor, and they might lose that beautiful meeting room with a view out over the hillside where you feel like you can see eternity. Would that be a bad thing? Would the work of the church telling about the life beyond the hotel be compromised if they lost that room? Or is it compromised by saying nothing about wage injustice? Now, I say Anglicans because we're a former British colony, but if I was in Sweden, I'd say Lutherans. If I was in Scotland, I'd say Presbyterians. If I was in Italy, I'd say Catholics. It's whoever's been the state church. All of them are volunteering in the soup kitchen. They are all giving money to help the hotel down the river that got wiped out in a natural disaster. They are all trying to be kind to their family. They are all trying to be friendly to the family in the next room. They are all trying to be faithful to the story of Jesus. They all read their Bibles. And they all find a story that supports the choice they've made. And these last things about all are really important, because we cannot love our fellow Christians if we think that anyone who disagrees with us, well, they don't really care about the poor, or they're actually living a bit immorally, or they're not really following Jesus. And increasingly there are questions about whether we should be challenging not just how the hotel runs, but whether it exists at all. God doesn't intend for us to live in parallel, these people are saying, but in a community. Life in God is not intended to be a hotel, but a family home. And our task is to see the family of God now, not just in the hereafter, and to live in that family of God reality, even or perhaps especially if it means unpicking the structures of the hotel. So where are you in the hotel? Did you recognise yourself, or did any of those caricatures just needle at you? Because that might be a clue that that could be you. Especially if you went, well, that's a bit unfair, because it probably was. What are the strengths of your position? And what are the potential weaknesses that may be where you felt needled? What can you learn from the other viewpoints? And we recognise that none of us here, by luck of birth, are in the Indigenous community out the back. And probably none of us here are with the oppressed workers in the basement. We come at these questions as people of privilege. We are utterly, utterly loved by God forever. And we are called to live in ways that reflect that love back into the world. So we need to listen to perspectives that are different to ours to maintain a healthy balance of living in the present and maintaining a hope for the future, of receiving grace and of reflecting grace. I would invite you this week to think about where you are in the hotel, and maybe to visit some people on the other floors, even if it's in your imagination, and have some conversations about why they are where they are. However far we think the love ethic of Jesus stretches, there is no doubt that it stretches to loving other Christians. So whatever struck you today, let it resource you for loving other believers. Particularly, let it resource how you speak to and speak about other Christians as we encounter each other in public life. Does anyone want to? to ask a question?
Loving everybody.
I absolutely mean that we need to love everybody, but in terms of wrestling with what does it mean to be a Christian and involved with the state, I think it's one of those issues that puts us in division from other Christians, and so I particularly am wanting to draw attention to how in this sphere we love other Christians. But yes, absolutely, please love other people who are not Christians.
Including politicians, right?
And including politicians who are not Christians.
And do the hotel rooms have minibars? Or
your one might, Ken. Which room are you in?
I'm conscious I'm a visitor here, but this is an area I'm really interested in. You mentioned very early that the Prime Minister's linked with a certain kind of theology, and I'm interested that you didn't particularly pick up on prosperity theology and its emergence, particularly in the church-state interaction, and its very strong links and political links. And I think with neoliberalism, if you see an alignment between neoliberalism and prosperity theology, it's really interesting. And I just see that as the missing maybe fifth green point, and I'm interested in your comments on it.
I think, yeah, they're in the penthouse. They've got a very nice room. My understanding is that mostly that comes out of Calvinist theology, this idea that the state and the governing authorities can work for good, and therefore if you have done well and worked for good and the state supports you in that, it works together. And it also often has a lean into the kind of end times stuff, that it's an evidence of the good that is coming, and the end that's coming is the fact that you are being blessed, inverted commas, by the abundance that you've got. But you're right, it is. All of these are terrible oversimplifications, and within each of those green categories it will divide into another 20 that nuance and overlay each other. But thank you for raising that, because it is, particularly in public life, it's a really important emphasis that's come out, this idea that being wealthy is what is the blessing of God.
I just had another caricature that there's perhaps another conversation that the whole hotel needs to have with the vulture capitalists and hedge fund backers that are planning to raise the whole hotel and build a gated community.
With so many people in so many rooms, conversation is only possible, real conversation is only possible if you allow the other person's ideas to invade your own head, because otherwise all you're doing is waiting for them to finish. You have to accept the possibility that you could be wrong or there might be other ideas. And unfortunately, one of the characteristics of many of those rooms is that that's not a possibility. The starting point is, I'm right and I can't possibly be wrong. So for those of us who are in the room where we can allow a multiplicity of ideas, I believe it's actually possible to teach people that it's okay if you're possibly wrong. And I preached a sermon earlier this year about living outside our bubble. And what I discovered was that my caricature of those other people was thinking that they think that they're possible, that can only be right. And what I discovered was that's not the case. What we just need to rediscover is the art of civil conversation, and that those ideas will lose a lot of their potency, and that we might consider alternatives. But the best way to do that is to start the conversation with the people we most fear.
Which might mean you have to leave your room and stand somewhere awkward like the corridor.
The thing that disturbed me, Claire, was both your comment and people's reaction to the comment about politicians. I know and have known a number of people who served in politics. They're all Labour or Green. I can't speak for Liberals. Most of them are just people. And they're not necessarily in it for themselves or because they love power or because they get big pensions at the end of it. I've actually seen people age astonishingly over the period of time that are in Parliament. And so I think the first thing we need to look at is our actual attitude to people who serve us in Parliament, not just sort of, oh, it must be so terribly hard to love politicians. They're just people, like anybody.
Thank you, Bobby. And I hope nothing I've said was denigrating to politicians. I think they come at their job from different perspectives, but they, my sense is they go into it because they believe in something.
I just want to follow that comment of Bobby's. The way I see the politicians is there's almost two things. There's the position of politician and what a politician is expected to do by the machine, the party, the system, etc. And then there's the human beings that actually occupy those positions. I was once involved in being the health, one of many health advisors to Michael Waldridge when he was the health minister. And I was shocked at the number of people who saw he was fair game for manipulation and getting what they wanted. So that gave me a very different perspective on politicians.
Can you please talk about the kingdom of God and how that... Sorry. Because... From my experience. Yes, I am. Yeah.
And I meant to ask him when I get home, isn't it?
We did briefly. We have several conversations in the weeks leading up to Claire doing a sermon. So we did briefly touch on it, but it's one of my questions in that came out of those conversations and out of the sermon is how does, like, it seems to me that many different theological positions seem to have different understandings of the kingdom of God and the role of the kingdom in our political systems, and you know the idea that the kingdom is now but not yet, or the kingdom is still to come, or things like that. So that has direct implication about how we engage politically.
Part of the difference is the difference in interpretation in what the kingdom of God means. The reason I asked Luke to include a reading of the Sermon on the Mount is because that, for me, is core to what I think needs to be held as we engage the whole thing. I talked very briefly about the radical Orthodox movement, and that is particularly challenging the idea that the kingdom of God, that people have equated the kingdom of God with a particular political agenda, on the whole leftist, but not entirely, and that needs to be picked apart. We need to relook at what is this kingdom of God. Where is it? Who is it? How does it emerge? Are we responsible for bringing it in, or is it a work of God into which we fall? Yeah.
Can I make one brief comment? What I'm sitting with is, it's the journey I'm on, it's realising how much of my evangelical faith is premised on medieval theology, which is about doing your best living your best now so you're okay when you die. That's medieval theology. As opposed to my understanding of Jesus's reading is that for all the end time stuff, he's calling us to how we live now and about living the best now and doing it, the value of now and material world now. And so much, that makes a huge difference.
It does, and if I can pick on you, that understanding of Jesus is not universal.
Yeah.
That even now, that sense of, that's one of the key differences,
yeah.
Is Jesus talking about now or later or both, and how much? Yeah.